He was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. That's Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this December 9th Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. Today on the Old Mole, we will discuss where we are 10 years after defeating racist apartheid and why most blacks are poorer and less secure. Well-read Red Alan Weider digs past the Hallmark card eulogies following the death of Nelson Mandela to reveal the complexities and contradictions of the man and the struggle. Movie mole Fran Michel and her guest Lynn Macow review 12 Years a Slave, and Jay Thiemeyer reviews Sasha Abramski's book The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And we'll open this morning's show with Bill Resnick talking with South African historian and activist John Saul.
Hi, folks. I interviewed John Saul. He's a historian of South Africa and all of Southern Africa. He's written an enormous amount of material. Easy to find it. Just Google him. Look at the Wikipedia site. They're very interesting. He's still writing in the Socialist Register of 2012. Look for his article on South Africa. In fact, it's available on the web. The question we addressed was that despite the committed, courageous, patient, heroic, ultimately winning struggle by the South African liberation forces, of course, including Nelson Mandela, and forces around the world. But then, why did the mostly white corporations, South African and international, remain in control of South Africa, and the vast majority of blacks and poor remain black and poor, in fact, more insecure? We conclude the discussion that I had yesterday. I'm alive now. We conclude it with a short summary discussion of the recent rise around the world and in South Africa of forces challenging corporate power. The first issue that I raised with him was, please describe South Africa today. This is John Saul speaking.
The victory over apartheid is a crucial victory and a very welcome one and needs to be celebrated even today. It does remain a country in which the vast majority of the population is, in fact, even poorer than under apartheid. So that the transformation has been political and meaningfully so, but not socially and economically in any great depth. And so I think that's the bottom line of it, that the ANC, on Mandela's watch and afterwards, has not really transformed the country in any very meaningful way. They've opted for a neoliberal solution to their economic problems, which hasn't worked. And in fact, we can talk further about this later, but it has led to a growing rise of resistance. In fact, South Africa is now pretty much at the top of the international league table for demonstrations and protests and so on at the grassroots level, both by labor and by community groups, etc. Now, this is not yet accumulated into a kind of a clear counter-hegemonic alternative being offered to the ANC, but it does suggest that there's real distemper in the society, and how it will play out is, of course, anybody's guess.
Also, though, in South Africa today, what's striking is that the new regime has, in fact, made peace with a very, very, very small section of blacks who have become, some of them, quite rich and a few fabulously rich and live in guarded neighborhoods like the rich white people. It seems to me that it's now a semi-diversified elite versus...
Well, I think what you see is that the line of differentiation between the white population and the black population has narrowed somewhat, in large part because some blacks have got quite wealthy. But the gap between rich and poor is widening. So this is suggesting that, of course, while this is still largely raced, in terms of those at the bottom are largely black, It's no longer just a racial society. It's primarily a class society. And differential classes are the name of the game to a considerable degree.
This is KB Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to John Saul, a historian and analyst of Southern Africa. Particularly today, we're talking about South Africa and the South African, the end of apartheid, but the end of apartheid ultimately now is concluded in a class state, as you heard, dominated by corporate capital, with some, in fact, very rich blacks and some middle-class blacks.
Yeah, no question. There is some degree of upward mobility in those terms, but the gap remains, if anything, wider than it was in the old days. Now even more defined in terms of rich and poor than in terms of black and white, although those categories, the latter categories, also still have some weight and meaning.
Right. John Saul, how did that happen? The great promise of South Africa, the great revolutionary movements have been tamed. What was the process through which that occurred? It even began long before the fall of apartheid.
Well, it certainly did. I mean, I think you have to look at this as a two-pronged strategy of resistance to apartheid. There was an incredible mobilization, not by the ANC exclusively or even mainly, both among the working class and among the impoverished poor, that led to a mass movement in the 1980s that really put the scare into particularly global capital, who began to realize that banking on apartheid was no longer a very wise thing to do. So they began to think, well, this isn't going to work very well for us in the long run. We could not only have a nationalist transformation, but also a revolution. Unfortunately, from the point of view of those at the bottom of the society, the African National Congress, which remained a distinct player through all this, but primarily in exile, not so much on the ground inside the country where the real action was, as it happens, began under Thabo Mbeki and others to begin to talk to global capital. And slowly but surely, in the 1980s, yes, well before independence, they had begun to make a deal with capital to allow for a relatively tame resolution, a resolution that is somewhat ominously similar to the kind that Frantz Fanon wrote about it earlier about the upper percentage of the continent, when he said there's going to be a false decolonization that's taking place, whereby, yes, the old colonial powers, in this case the old white elite and regime, will disappear, but the situation will remain one in which the country, under black leadership, remains as subordinate to global capital as it was before. And that's exactly what has happened. And the ANC did this in part by accepting power on those terms, but also by suppressing the mass movement. The UDF was wound down, the United Democratic Front, which is one of the major force, really, of popular resistance inside the country alongside KASATU, the trade union, in the 1980s, was actually wound up. They did vote for it, but there was a lot of dissident voices who said, we can't really quite trust the ANC when it comes to power to continue the process of transformation, and they were right.
Tell us about the UDF, which was rooted all over South Africa.
Well, the UDF was a pyramid organization of a whole range of community-level organizations, and it did have some ANC and a whole range of other kinds of ingredients to it, but first and foremost, it was a movement of popular resistance, and it was not itself organizing it so much as reflecting it. The various resistances that were taking place throughout the country and in a whole wide range of things, beginning with Soweto, primarily in the 1970s, and this was under the auspices of the Black Consciousness Movement, if you can relate to that long ago, slowly but surely it was spreading across the country and became a very powerful force for resistance and transformation in its own terms. And then it became, eventually, as an umbrella organization, the UDF. And the UDF was a crucial voice for change alongside KASATU, the leading trade union, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, that was pressing the government. And I think at a certain point there were people like Oppenheimer who said in the 1970s...
Oppenheimer was the head of the great mining conglomerate.
The Anglo-American Corporation, he was a great capitalist. And he began in the 1970s, but this is a bit too early for most capitalists to quite relate to it, to say we're on the wrong hiding here. If we don't get off the apartheid kick, we're going to lose everything. And then there were other people, as the 80s wore on, who began to move over to that position. In fact, one of the most articulate of them was Malcolm Fraser, who was the very conservative Prime Minister of Australia, but became head of the Commonwealth Eminent Persons Group that went to South Africa in the mid-80s to investigate things. And he said very clearly, we've got to get rid of apartheid in order to save capitalism. And Zak de Beer said this, another prominent South African capitalist said much the same thing. He said, we can't allow the baby of capitalism to be washed out with the bathwater of apartheid. We've got to change. They found the ANC willing to play that
right.
game.
And they, of course, had also the opposition on the right, that is, the intelligent capitalists who...
Well, the intelligent capitalists, yeah, there was, of course. I mean, the state was not unimportant, obviously, and the state was very repressive. But slowly but surely, there were sea changes taking place within the apartheid regime itself, which is primarily premised on race as much as capital. The two things went hand in glove for a long period of time. Capital began slowly but surely to edge itself away, but also it began to transform the national party, because there were Afrikaner elites who began to feel themselves more and more comfortable with capitalist logic than with racial logic. And so they began to work away at the national party. And in fact, if you think of P.W. Botha, who was the last but one of the white presidents of South Africa before F.W. de Klerk, he was actually came into power as a reformer. Now, when it became, you know, reforming this system, but he couldn't really drop enough of apartheid to really reform it, and he became more of an oppressive dictator, really. F.W. de Klerk, who was also a racist and was comfortable with the National Party rule until it was obvious it wasn't going to last, was the one who, when he came into power in the late 80s, began to think, well, we can do a deal here on behalf of capital with the ANC and wind up still, on the whole, the bulk of the well-off whites controlling the situation. And that's what happened.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to John Saul about the transition to neoliberal capitalism in South Africa, a terrible story for most blacks in South Africa. One of the last people to be convinced that the apartheid state, or some of the last people to be convinced, were in fact familiar names in the United States, like Ronald Reagan or Miss Thatcher in England. They hung with the apartheid supporters for a long time until they were convinced to support the boycott. Tell us that story.
Well, I think there was a mixed feeling here. And our own Prime Minister in Canada, Brian Mulroney, was an interesting swing figure in this, because he listened to Malcolm Fraser, who went to South Africa, as I mentioned earlier, and who said, we've got to really rethink apartheid because we're going to wind up facing a revolution against capitalism if we don't move quickly. And Mulroney bought that logic, and he at the G8 actually pushed both Thatcher and Reagan to wake up and smell the coffee and begin to think about allowing for change in South Africa, or at least going with it. And the only thing about Mulroney was that he also was very suspicious of the ANC, because they, as far as he was concerned, they were, quote, terrorists. So he wanted to have his cake and eat it, too. Is there some way that we can do away with apartheid without the liberation movement, the ANC, and the variety of domestic insurrections that were occurring in South Africa becoming the driving force? And so in the end, he kind of himself lost his nerve in terms of change, but the change came anyway, because capital and increasingly the Afrikaner elite felt they had no choice but to try and figure out how to let the blacks into power, although de Klerk, till the very last minute, had various schemes to try and qualify that, let the blacks into power, but on our terms being no longer continuing racial domination, but a class domination as capitalists. And that's what happened. Reagan and Thatcher eventually saw the logic of this position. They could no longer hold out for the status quo.
Let's talk about some of the terrorists, that is, the people who were seen as terrorists in that period, communist terrorists, in fact. One of them was Nelson Mandela.
You wouldn't know that to hear them all talking now.
Discuss Mandela, the mixed legacy of Mandela, clearly.
Well, it's a hard thing to discuss, Bill, because, you know, on the one hand, of course, there's no question that Mandela is a hero. Quite simply, that's what he is. And he was an impressive figure who stood forward with principle throughout this period, 27 years in jail, as coming off a strong record of resistance to apartheid prior to going to jail. He's 27 years in jail, and he didn't really budge from resisting white oppression in that period. And so when it came time to begin to change things from the point of view of capital and even of the white elite politically, Mandela was still there saying, we're going to accept this change, but not in any kind of modified way. We want it to be about real democracy. And so up until, say, 1990, when he came out of prison, he was a militant critic and resistor to the system. Now, when he came out, if you may recall, from prison, the very first speech he gave that very same day in Cape Town, he said, we are going to nationalize these kinds of industries, etc. And when he went to Davos, even in 1992, he was still talking about socioeconomic change of very...
Davos is the international conference of peak capitalists.
Yeah, well, yeah. At that meeting in 92, he was still talking about we need a real socioeconomic revolution in South Africa. He started to move away from that position because the ANC in exile had already moved away from that position by and large. Certainly Mbeki and many of the other senior people had. And so slowly but surely, Mandela joined that team. And even in that transition period from 1990 to 1994, when de Klerk was still in power and the ANC did not come in until 1994 when they won the first genuine national election, they had started to make compromises vis-a-vis capital. Alongside the outgoing National Party government, they began to make deals with the IMF and the World Bank and a whole range of other such players. And so you had, in a sense, a false decolonization. If you read The Wretched of the Earth by Van Owen, which was written in 1960, so it was a much antedated any changes that took place in South Africa, he's talking about what happened in most African countries during that period was a false decolonization, and I'm afraid it reads just as if it could apply today exactly to what happened in South Africa. Uh-huh.
To give them credit, during that period, though, they were also pushing Mandela to call off the armed insurrection, to call off the people who were actually attacking South African interests all over Southern Africa, that South Africa was losing battles, and they appealed to Mandela, call it off. We want a peaceful transition. And during the period, until the end of apartheid, he refused to accept that logic.
This is what makes it hard, Bill. I mean, you can come up with lots of arguments about why he should have done more. But the bottom line at one level is that, of course, what he was resisting was a racial dictatorship, and that was overthrown. So, I mean, you have to give him full marks, and the ANC full marks, and a whole range of others full marks, for making that happen. There's no question about that. This is what makes it so difficult to adopt a critical and reflective line about it, because you can't downplay the importance of that victory. At the same time, slowly but surely, and not so very slowly, the ANC and even Mandela were accepting a non-racial solution on capital's terms. And that had its costs, too. That led to a situation which has not really transformed the socioeconomic structure, even though it has transformed the political structure of South Africa. How do you add it up? What do you say? That this is a major triumph? Of course it was at one level. Was it a major loss? Yes, that's true too. You know, it's a very difficult position to have because everybody now is saying, well, Mandela was great, it was a great change. True. But, and the but is important too.
This is KBO Radio 90.7 FM, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to John Saul, historian of South Africa. We discuss how the Great Liberation Movement ultimately resulted in a continued mostly white with some token black. In any event, the basic recolonization of South Africa with black faces at the top and in some middle sections as well. Real briefly, John Saul, just tell us about some of the actions actually by the Mandela government when he was president and the ANC that cemented, you know, capitalist rule, like, for example, a commitment to pay back all of the debts of South Africa that the white Afrikaner government had contracted for, the agreements with the IMF, a constitution that makes property rights paramount. It seems to me they really were maneuvered ultimately into accepting rule by the corporate elite.
Well, I guess the only thing I would quarrel with that, and you're absolutely right, and you've said it as eloquently as I could do so, but But I think maneuvered into may be a bit of a mistake of phraseology, because they bought that line. They weren't maneuvered into doing things that they didn't want to do. They chose to do that, and I think that's very important. Naomi Klein has written a very good chapter in her book, but it's very good only up to a point. The shock doctrine, you know, she has a chapter on South Africa, and in it, she adopts the language of maneuvered into it, too. This, she says, happened while the ANC was kind of caught napping. Not true. The ANC, on the whole, bought that position and bought that strategy. They bought into the recolonization of South Africa in their own interests as a rising class and as a black elite.
John Saul, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Okay, man.
Right.
My pleasure.
So long.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7. This is listener-supported community radio. That was Freedom's Children, a psychedelic hard rock band in 1960s South Africa. Music was incredibly important to the people, both as a celebration and, of course, politically. Later on, the Old Mole will hear a review of 12 Years a Slave and a book review of The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. But next we have Alan Weider. He is going to talk about Nelson Mandela and the complexities and contradictions of the man and the struggle. Alan is an Old Mole and the author of the book Ruth First and Joe Slovo in the War Against Apartheid. Alan?
Thanks, Denise. What a privilege to follow John Saul, who is arguably one of the most critical and thoughtful writers on Southern Africa. And by the way, while he taught in Maputo, was in the Department of Marxism and Leninism. We don't have many of those in the United States. So I'm going to talk about Nelson Mandela within the vein of what John and Bill talked about. Unfortunately, press coverage in the United States has turned Mandela into a Hallmark greeting card figure. And while Mandela's role as a freedom fighter and the major force in reconciliation in the new democratic South Africa should be honored and celebrated, we must remember that we're talking about a complex revolutionary and also a complex politician. No one argues with Mandela's leadership in the African National Congress during the 50s and through the 1964 Rivonia trial, where he and seven comrades were sentenced to life imprisonment. The key word here, though, is comrades, because Nelson Mandela always worked with other people in the struggle against apartheid. President Barack Obama was totally in error when he said that Mandela's life proved the power of one man with courage and vision could change the world. So point number one, Nelson Mandela worked with comrades throughout the struggle and beyond. Internal colonialism, racism, class disparity, and extreme oppression were part of South African history long before the apartheid regime came to power in the late 1940s. Nelson Mandela collaborated with other activists, black, Indian, colored, and white, at Wits University in Johannesburg, and it was within this grouping, as well as from his fellow African National Congress Youth League leaders, that he came to a belief in non-racialism. He clearly stated that it was the struggle commitment of fellow students at Wits, as well as his close friends and struggle stalwarts, Walter Sisulu and Oliver Tambo, that changed his view on the struggle. A view that went from African unity and only fighting racism to a belief that imperialism, class disparity, and racism were all connected. Countless are the continuing statements on Nelson Mandela as a man of peace and love and forgiveness. None of them are untrue, yet they are clearly only a partial portrait, as Nelson Mandela was part of a struggle fighting against what Bishop Desmond Tutu often refers to as a pigmentocracy. Throughout the 1950s, beginning with the Defiance campaign against the magnification of racist legislation, to the Freedom Charter, calling for democracy for all South Africans, to the 1956 treason trial, the mission of Mandela and his struggle comrades was to change the South African government. However Gandhian the strategy and tactics of this part of the struggle took, the government oppression became more harsh, more violent, and more oppressive. Thus, by 1962, for Nelson Mandela, who had gone underground, as well as his comrades, it could not be all peace and love. Before he was arrested that year, Mandela was clandestinely interviewed by British journalist Brian Widlake. Mandela said, "If the government reaction is to crush by naked force our nonviolent demonstrations, we will have to seriously reconsider our tactics. In my mind, we are closing a chapter on this question of nonviolent policy." Mandela was actually asking the apartheid regime, once again, to question their own policy of harsh, violent repression. And what he was proposing at this point was not actually armed struggle, but rather armed propaganda, attacks on government facilities in an attempt to show that the apartheid regime was not invulnerable. At this point, 1962, armed propaganda didn't do much to reach this goal, and the 1963 arrests at Rivonia crippled the struggle for almost a decade. Yet, even at trial, Nelson Mandela was a revolutionary. His message certainly wasn't peace and love. Mandela went to Robben Island Prison in 1964 and would not see freedom until 1990. In fact, his face was not even seen in a photograph in South Africa again until 1988, representation of the totality of apartheid. His interactions in prison, however, were both revolutionary and human, and in spite of the harsh conditions he faced, he was involved in political conversations across the boundaries of competing struggle organizations, and was very much part of what prisoners referred to as Robben Island, our university. But Nelson Mandela spent the struggle years in prison, and it was comrades like Oliver Tambo, Chris Hani, Joe Slovo, Paula Jordan, Ronnie Casserolls, and younger MK soldiers that continued the struggle in exile. Within South Africa, black people on the ground and the United Democratic Front kept the struggle alive. But by the mid-80s, Nelson Mandela was part of the conversations with the apartheid regime, and he was released in 1990. It must be remembered that South Africa did not have a successful armed revolution, but rather a negotiated settlement. And this is where Nelson Mandela becomes a politician. So while I do not begrudge the peace and love eulogies nor question the magnitude of the end of organized and legislative apartheid in South Africa, I again think it is important to view Mandela with more complexity. No one will ever claim that the negotiations with the apartheid regime were easy, and it is here where Mandela's brilliance as a politician comes front and center, for both good and bad. Yes, it was important that he publicly stood up to de Klerk, but one has to question whether these clashes played well for both men within their own constituencies. We have to also wonder at which point the United States, United Kingdom, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund entered negotiations about negotiations. In a sense, it was the formal negotiations between the ANC and the apartheid regime that exemplified Mandela's political brilliance. Nelson Mandela basically sidelined, albeit temporarily, Thabo Mbeki, and chose three negotiators that represented the far left of the struggle: Cyril Ramaphosa, then of the Mine Workers Union, and Joe Slovo and Mac Maharaj from the Communist Party. Did Madiba know that selling what would surely become a neoliberal transition to the struggle left was more difficult than negotiating with the enemy? Did Madiba know that he needed Joe Slovo to proclaim the sunset clauses that would protect the jobs of apartheid regime bureaucrats? Questions, but surely worth asking. What we do know is that neoliberalism came with vengeance to South Africa, and that the ANC and President Mandela became partners with the West. But we also know that in the early struggle years, Nelson Mandela was a revolutionary who believed and fought for a people's democracy. So even if there is much more complexity than the present eulogies exhibit, Mandela is still deserving. And the hope, at least from my perspective, is that the love of people that these hallmark eulogies proclaim will lead to 1980s-like struggle conversations and actions that address the class disparity, lack of services, freedom of press issues, and corruption that exist in South Africa today. This has been Alan Weider for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Next up on the Old Mole, we'll hear a review of 12 Years of Slave, but let's also look at what's coming up on KBOO this morning. At 10 o'clock, it's Chris Andre, host of Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein, the topic is public art in natural areas. At 11, Health Watch is off today. Instead, we'll hear Food Sleuth Radio featuring an interview with dietitian April Winslow. And at 11:30 on Radio Zine, host Sutri Irving speaks with Penny Rosenwasser about her new book, Hope into Practice, Jewish Women Choosing Justice Despite Our Fears. And now, Old Mole, Fran Michelle.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here with guest movie mole Lynn Macau, assistant professor of English, women's and gender studies, and American ethnic studies at Willamette University, and a scholar of the genre of the neo-slave narrative, post-Civil War stories of the era of chattel slavery in the United States. We're here today to discuss 12 Years a Slave, the film directed by Steve McQueen from a script by John Ridley, and currently playing in Portland at the nonprofit Hollywood Theater and elsewhere. 12 Years a Slave is based on the nonfiction 1850 narrative by Solomon Northup, played in the film by Chiwetel Ejiofor. The film begins in a sugarcane field, but flashes back and forward to show what has led Solomon here. A free black man living in upstate New York with his wife and children, Solomon was offered a short-term job playing violin for two white circus performers in Washington, D.C. But when they get him to the South, they drug him with wine, and he wakes up in chains, his money and papers and name gone. His new captors tell him his name is Platt and beat him until he stops protesting that he's really a free man. He's shipped south and sold first to a plantation owner named Ford, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, and later to a cotton farmer named Edwin Epps, played by Michael Fassbender. Various plans and attempts to rebel or escape go awry until a Canadian carpenter named Bass, played by Brad Pitt, helps get a letter to the North, and he's finally rescued and reunited with his family. This film has been widely praised, although some people have objected to the violence in the film. What do we think about that?
Thank you for having me here, first of all. The violence in the film is spectacular on the one hand, but necessarily so, I think. Often what we'll see is the unexpected violences that we maybe aren't so used to or expecting to see. So violences that are implied as well as those that are explicit. The violence is done to enslaved women's bodies. Sometimes we see that portrayed by the character Patsy, who undergoes a long-term violent relationship with the plantation owner Epps. But this film really opens right after showing enslaved people at work in the sugar fields with a kind of unexpected moment of intimacy between a character credited only as the mulatto woman who uses Solomon's body for a sexual release that I think it makes a reference to the implicit violence of what happened and what was done repeatedly to enslaved women. So rather than having sexual violence made part of this character's experience forced upon her, we see the woman taking her ownership over a sexual connection. And that seems very unusual to see that depicted. And I don't think it's portrayed in a way that is explicitly titillating. I think more is implied than shown.
Yeah, there certainly are instances of graphic violence, which is presumably what people are objecting to when they say, oh, the film is so violent. And there really is a genuine concern about the nature of portrayal of, particularly of black suffering. The critic Saidiya Hartman has talked about the way that that can become a kind of spectacle that is satisfying to the watchers. And that's, I think, really not what this film is doing. As you say, it's really not portrayed voyeuristically, but we see not only the sort of obvious violence of whippings and hangings, but the much more subtle violences of intimate relations, of the ways that people are watching each other and the things that people say that are violent. And as you say, when we see Patsy being violated by Epps, it's not presented voyeuristically. We focus on a close-up of their faces, and particularly her face. And as with the opening scene with the mulatto woman, there's nothing titillating about it.
Yeah, and I think it's especially striking that when we see those moments of the more expected violence, so the beatings, the whippings, we're given insight into how those characters respond. And so we see close-ups of characters' faces. We watch them, I think, in a way that could be read as a spectacular and problematic kind of voyeuristic scene in some cases, until, and I think this is kind of a testament to McQueen's director's eye, we move away from just the expected and we stay in the scene long enough to watch those responses, to watch the faces register the kind of emotional response to what's being done to them. So yeah, it's uncomfortable to watch, but I think that that discomfort is a necessary discomfort. The film doesn't sanitize the violence of the institution of chattel slavery.
Yeah, as you're suggesting, slavery itself was incredibly violent, much more violent, really, than we see in this film. And we haven't seen that. This is, I guess, the first time a feature film has been made from a story written by someone who had been enslaved. And it's kind of amazing that we haven't gotten that before. But it's a very different kind of story than some of the other representations of slavery that we've gotten on film up till now. One of the things that is also very different is that we get a lot of attention to the fact that slavery is about labor. We open, and this is one of the things the film does differently than the original text, we open with labor. We open with a scene in the cane field and the workers getting instructions on, this is how you cut the cane, now do it. And a lot of scenes in the film of the kinds of work in the cane field, work in the cotton field, and how difficult it is to pick cotton, as well as a wide variety of other kinds of labor that slaves are expected to perform and, of course, coerced into performing.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by the kinds of depictions of labor that we see in the film that we may not have thought of as part of slave labor. So in addition to field work, we also, you know, we see Platt being forced to play his violin, his fiddle, at various events. We have a really shocking scene, I think, for a lot of viewers, of the enslaved community being forced to dance for their owners in the middle of the night, woken up from their sleep, their very precious sleep, to perform, and to perform a kind of grotesque joy and dance and sing and play. And I think that is one of the ways that 12 Years a Slave makes visible the kinds of violences that were done to enslaved people and the lack of limit to the types of labor that they were expected to perform, sometimes simply for their owner's amusement.
And of course, in addition to the labor for the owner's amusement or the owner's sexual satisfaction, there is, of course, the economic labor that's really central. And I found it really fascinating to see that the way that the results of their labor in the cotton fields were assessed functions as a kind of, it's a prehistory to Taylorism and management techniques that are still in place today. The slaves are told that they have there's a certain amount they have to pick. Everybody should be able to pick this much, 200 pounds a day. If they pick less than that, then they get whipped. If they pick less than they picked the day before, so there's a kind of constant ramping up. It's always got to be more or they're punished. And I think that has parallels in all kinds of labor speed-ups that we see happening today as well.
It's striking to me, too, to bring it back to the sexual and reproductive labor, to recognize how doing all of the work, being completely complicit, we see Patsy again as this sort of central character who is the best cotton picker. She's the most productive laborer, and she's also the primary concubine for her owner, and yet none of that labor is rewarded. There's no economic return for her in terms of increased status. In fact, it singles her out for further retribution and violent hostility from her mistress, from her owner. Those moments of just the kind of shocking return or lack of return for labor, I think the film highlights.
Yeah, and the portrayal of the white mistress is also something that we don't see a lot in previous representations of slavery, but that we do see certainly in slave narratives, particularly in slave narratives by women, that the white mistress, who is, of course, jealous of her husband's attention to this woman, although, of course, the Patsy does not want his attention in that way, but we see her intervening when they're dancing, and she goes up to Patsy and she cuts her face and she throws things at her, and she's constantly abusing her. So poor Patsy is getting it from Epps, who is raping her at night, and from his wife, who is hitting her and cutting her and throwing things at her. And then finally she's, well, there is no final. We see her still standing at the plantation as Solomon drives away when he's finally rescued.
Mm-hmm. And I think ending the images of life in slavery with Patsy, and Patsy with an unresolved future before her, I think is a stark reminder to the viewer to keep in mind that while we have Solomon getting away from this experience and being returned to the life that we see him in at the beginning and what we always know is there waiting for him, or hopefully will still be there when he gets free, we are left with this really hopeless image of what happens to everyone left behind, everyone who is not in the exceptional position that Solomon is in.
Yeah, there's a kind of trajectory that his character follows from initially when he wakes up in the dark in chains protesting, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm a free man. I'm not supposed to be here. Well, of course, it's not as though anyone really should be there. But it takes him a while to come to recognize his solidarity with the people around him and the community around him. And the film does, if it has a fault, it's that perhaps necessary fault of focusing on someone who is exceptional. I mean, the only people who were able to write slave narratives were the ones who were able to escape from slavery and who were literate enough to be able to write their stories. So the very existence of slave narratives depends on people who were exceptional. And there's a way in which the film offers a kind of exceptionalism in a lot of different ways, actually.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reviews that, or several reviews actually, have made this argument that the contemporary, I guess I would say neoliberal viewer, can identify with Solomon from the opening scenes, the early scenes that we see of him living his life in the North. Here he is, a free man, he's employed, he has a wife, he has a home, he has children, and it's an easy entry point. So I think that there's an argument to be made for why that works for a film made in this contemporary moment, that the average viewer is going to want to see themselves somehow portrayed, and finding a way to connect with the protagonist obviously works on that level. But what I worry about is that we then move as viewers through this process that ultimately redeems Solomon, leaving, as we've said, all the other enslaved people behind. And so how far does the critique really go? I mean, we recognize the horrors of slavery throughout the film's portrayal, but at the end, again, I'm not sure what is resolved beyond Solomon's own unique, exceptional situation.
And of course, in its own time, the narrative that Solomon wrote was meant to portray the horrors of slavery and persuade people that the institution should be ended. And writing in the 1850s, this was a really pressing concern. And then the question comes up of, well, why are we seeing so many films today about this period in American history, and for the first time getting a film made from a slave narrative? And that, too, is an interesting question. I mean, I think there's, to some extent, there's the factor of people being able to leave the film. I mean, the cynical side of this is the people being able to leave the film and say, we've come so far, we've learned so much. But it's also, presumably, there's more going on than that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my biggest fear with the whole spectacle of violence that we started talking about is that it mimics something of the 19th century precedent of what was called voyeuristic abolitionism, or kind of portraying these spectacles of violence done to the enslaved body that didn't actually recuperate a sense of that body as a person or a human. Though the end result was to abolish and end slavery, it didn't humanize the victims of that system. So can we watch 12 Years a Slave and come away with it with a sense of the humanity restored to the enslaved characters? I think that that does happen, but it has to reach across a kind of presumption on the part of the viewer that what they're seeing is this horror and violence, but that it's left in the past, that there is no repercussion still today. Whereas I think it's pretty obvious that we do still live with the repercussions of race-based slavery. We still live with the discontinuity between humanity for people that we see as more or less valuable in our society. And I think that the film, therefore, is very relevant and is relevant in part for its realistic portrayals, as opposed to a film like Django Unchained. So it's predecessor just by less than a year, which is also depicting violence and violence sometimes in a hyper-realistic or hyper almost comedic way. Django does that. 12 Years a Slave does everything but that.
Well, violence or no, you should absolutely go see this film. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michelle
and Lynn McHale
talking about 12 Years a Slave. Go see it.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Denise Morris, your host this morning on KBOO 90.7. Joe Clement is our engineer. We've been discussing South African politics in the wake of the death of Nelson Mandela. You actually just heard Letta Mbulu, who was a jazz singer. She was born in 1942 in Soweto, South Africa, and began her career in the 1960s, but by the mid-60s, she had moved to the United States due to apartheid and had a quite wonderful career, so I would definitely suggest folks check her out. We're going to play another piece of music today. I thought it would be nice to look at some of the music that's not so specifically political but celebratory and a reflection of the kinds of influences that impacted the development of South African music. We'll go now to the Jazz Epistles. Thank you. All right, this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. It's Monday, December 9th. Joe Clement has been our engineer. And this is Denise Morris. I've been your host. Yes, it's a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. I want to thank Bill Resnick and John Soule for their discussion of South African politics, Alan Weider for his discussion of Nelson Mandela, and Fran Michel, Lynn Macau reviewed 12 Years a Slave. And next week, or in a week to come, we'll hear from Jay Thiemeyer, his review on The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. We've also been listening to some South African music this morning, and we're going to go to one last piece by the Soul Brothers. They are an extremely popular band and have also been performing and producing music for decades in South Africa.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. We just heard the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program was made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or CSTPDX.com. Up next is Air Cascadia after these messages.
KABU is seeking a station manager to lead our dynamic 45-year-old non-commercial radio station. Ideal candidates will have nonprofit management experience, the ability to thrive and work collaboratively in a decentralized organization, and the ability to delegate, plan, and organize people to meet goals and objectives. If this interests you, please go to kboo.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
Cascadia. Today is Monday, December 9th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. We've got Kitts Hubbard's re-election announcement, a lot of history there and a lot of explaining to do. Kevin Gostola is with us too on talking points that the NSA management sends home with employees over Christmas to deflect questions from families about, Daddy, what did you do at the office today? And Ellen Brown joins us to discuss how public banking could have saved Detroit and might be the only way to save our own city in a grim future scenario. Ellen's most recent piece came out, was posted yesterday on Truthdig, Amend the Fed. We need a central bank that serves Main Street. Ellen is good. This is going to be a good one. And the weather for today, partly sunny, a chance of snow in the afternoon, highs around 30, light wind, except, of course, out in the gorge. And for tonight, clouds moving on, overcast skies, chance of snow and possibly freezing drizzle, lows around 25, and again, windy in the gorge, up to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, look for cloudy skies, snow is likely,